Today's Puritans aren't the Pilgrims. Today's Puritans are progressives.
Ryan Anderson, speaking at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
And so the new form of the Puritan mistake, my co-author Sharif Gerges and I have called it progressive Puritanism. These are people who want to force Roman Catholic nuns to pay for contraception. They want to force evangelical bakers to create custom wedding cakes for same-sex weddings. They now want to force Catholic hospitals to perform sex reassignment surgeries and to perform hormone therapy, testosterone therapy on women who want to identify as men. They're the ones trying to shut down faith-based, including Lutheran adoption agencies.
You can listen to Making the Case for Our First Freedoms with Ryan Anderson on an audio DVD or thumb drive of our 2018 Making the Case conferences. We'll send it to you for a financial gift of $300. Order today at issuesetc.org. Some evangelical leaders are saying that we need to be fair with everyone, apply the golden rule, and their way of doing it is what's being called the fairness for all approach to both religious freedom and LGBT rights, something those two freedoms and rights have been at loggerheads everywhere, especially legally in the United States lately. Is this the solution? Joining us to talk about the golden rule and the fairness for all approach to LGBT rights and religious freedom, Monica Burke. She's a research assistant in the DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society at the Heritage Foundation. Monica, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you so much for having me, Todd.
So what do the advocates of fairness for all claim about their approach's ability to protect religious liberty?
So the advocates of fairness for all policy generally advocate that given the current cultural situation that we find ourselves in, where the LGBT cause has been embraced by so many people and we're seeing across the country these conflicts with people who feel that in their conscience that they can't cooperate with some of this ideology, they think that the best solution is for us to impose nationwide anti-discrimination policies that include sexual orientation and gender identity as protected classes, and then to include religious exemptions for people who, for religious reasons, wish to opt out of certain circumstances. However, this ultimately fails on its own merits. It does not achieve fairness for all. It's actually imposing bad policy on everyone and then exempting the lucky few. And that's never going to fulfill the golden rule. It's not certainly not treating others the way that we wish to be treated.
More generally speaking, what are SOGI laws and what is their goal?
Of course, absolutely. So SOGI is shorthand for sexual orientation and gender identity laws. So what are those? So as many of your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar, in the Civil Rights Act, for example, it's stipulated that race is a protected class and you cannot discriminate on that basis. So what these laws attempt to do is to recreate what we have on the basis of either race or biological sex. In D.C., we also have it on the basis of political affiliation, and say that you can't discriminate against somebody on the basis of their sexual orientation or their gender identity. However, these terms are pretty problematic in law for a host of reasons, the first of which is, unlike race or biological sex, these are by their definition fluid categories. So what constitutes a gender identity? Facebook has 65 options, so it's very difficult to narrow down what that term means, which of course wreaks havoc on how we implement the law. And then the other problem is that a lot of people are pushing these laws precisely in order to antagonize people who hold a traditional view of marriage. So your listeners might recall Jack Phillips, the baker who personally does not believe in same-sex marriage. He's a Christian, and he was asked by a same-sex couple to create a custom wedding cake. The wedding cake they ended up getting had a rainbow on the inside, which is a testament to how expressive this kind of cake is. And he explained to them that it was not because of who they were, but it was precisely because there was an event that he couldn't comply with, that he simply could not. He would sell them anything else, but he couldn't produce this cake. And since then, he was slapped with a lawsuit, and his case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. Now, fortunately, Jack won, but unfortunately, he's not the only person who's facing this kind of legal action. So we should expect to see more of these kinds of cases nationwide.
Can you explain the current story that we're reading about with Fairness for All, what it is?
Absolutely. So what Fairness for All does is that it would implement those problematic SOGI policies, presumably nationwide, as they're trying to introduce it at the federal level. And then what it would do is try and include some religious liberty carve-out, so that there would be certain circumstances where if you're a religious organization, we won't expect you to comply in the way that we'd expect everyone else to comply with the law. But you can see how quickly that breaks down, particularly when it comes to the term gender identity. So as we've seen in Texas, there's been fights over this. There was fights in North Carolina over the quote-unquote bathroom bills, which was by including the term gender identity and anti-discrimination law, we've opened up sex-specific facilities to people of the opposite biological sex, which the concern here is not that transgender individuals will take advantage of the policy, but that with looser legal protections, that predators will be able to take advantage of the policy, that law enforcement will be less likely to get involved. Women will be more likely to say, you know, perhaps this person was trans and I misunderstood. So there's all kinds of problems that crop up, and that's just the gender identity piece. So imposing a bad policy and then exempting yourself as a religious person is by no means a good policy idea.
How do SOGI laws affect more than simply religious liberty?
Exactly. So you can easily conceive of a number of circumstances where people who might not even be religious could run afoul of these laws. An excellent context where that is definitely the case is the medical profession. So there's a whole spectrum of different opinions on what is appropriate when it comes to therapies for transgender individuals. There are some people who think that under no circumstances should someone be given cross-sex hormones or be allowed to pursue sex reassignment surgery, which is a very in-depth and even graphic procedure. There are people on the other side of the spectrum who would say, who would have very few barriers to being able to procure those treatments and in fact would allow children to take puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones as young as 5. But then there's people in between, so even someone who might be sympathetic to most people transitioning could be compelled under these Fairness for All policies against their will to do a sex reassignment surgery, to prescribe these hormones to a candidate who they say, you know, I actually don't think that this is best for this person's health. I think the risks outweigh the benefits. That could be a secular person. That could be someone who, as a general rule, takes no issue with LGBT thinking. So this by no means is going to just be an issue that's limited to people who have religious reasons to think that we're created men and female or to think to uphold the traditional ideal of marriage.
You mentioned a moment ago the golden rule. Evangelical advocates of Fairness for All, some of which are oddly remaining anonymous, say that they are simply following the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. What's your response?
Absolutely. So I would just reiterate that the golden rule prescribes that we do unto others as we would want them to do unto us. And so administering and advocating for a bad policy that leads to circumstances like the ones I mentioned, where physicians and nurses could be forced to do sex reassignment surgeries against their will, where people could be forced to have someone of the opposite biological sex in their changing room or their bathroom, circumstances like those, that's bad policy. And to say we're going to impose those and then exempt ourselves so that we're safe in our own unique circumstances because we meet those criteria, that by no means fulfills the golden rule. And so we need to take a step back and recognize that, yes, this can be an emotional issue, tensions can run high. However, this is not a viable solution. It actually creates more problems than it solves, and exempting ourselves from bad policy is not the way forward.
Why is elevating sexual orientation and gender identity to a protected class misguided in itself?
Exactly. So this gets back to a little bit of what I said earlier about the problems with these terms. Is from a legal standpoint, they don't work the same way that race or sex do, because race and sex are objective and immutable, they can't change, whereas sexual orientation and gender identity are by their very definition fluid. Laws in different states vary in terms of how they at least attempt to identify those things. It leaves them open for interpretation. And when they're open for interpretation, that means that everyone is subject to the whims of whatever judge so happens to hear their case, whether they construe those terms in a very narrow way, or whether they construe them in a broad way, like in Jack Phillips' case, where he was not discriminating against anyone on the basis of their sexual orientation. The same-sex couple that came to him, he was happy to do business with them. It was specifically when it came to a certain event, and most of all, a certain message about marriage that he couldn't agree with. And so ultimately, these laws just, they don't deliver on what they promise.
What must legitimate anti-discrimination laws do to truly protect everyone from unnecessary discrimination or the imposition of these conscience-violating rules and regulations?
That's an excellent question. So I think a term that is really, really useful in these dialogues is the term invidious discrimination, which can be a mouthful. Certainly, it's a very technical term. But what that distinction refers to is that discrimination also has, it has a negative connotation, like bans against interracial marriage, but it also has a neutral connotation, discriminating in the sense of simply making a distinction or making a choice or, you know, holding two things apart. So when we say that someone has, you know, very discriminating taste, it means that they're very good at making distinctions and sort of choosing the creme de la creme. When it comes to invidious discrimination, that specifically means the negative kind of discrimination. It means that you take into account a factor that's ultimately irrelevant. So to go back to the race analogy, in segregation, it's ultimately completely and totally irrelevant what color someone's skin is as for their capacity to hold a job or to use a public water fountain. No one's skin color has anything to do with those things, but where it's simply discrimination in the sense of making an important distinction. Sex is an excellent example there in the sense that there's a reason that men and women have separate facilities for the sake of privacy and safety. And so when it comes to enforcing discrimination law, we always want to focus in on that invidious discrimination, only on that negative kind, where someone's taking into account an irrelevant factor. And this is where the SOGI laws tend to not function so well, because sexual orientation and gender identity, sometimes the way we use the terms, blur the lines between an identity, so an attraction to a certain sex or a way of dressing, and actions, so having a marriage ceremony or pursuing some kind of surgery. And so the lines are very blurred there, and it becomes very difficult to determine when people are making distinctions based on ethical actions they don't agree with, and when they're discriminating against someone on the basis of just who they are. If we're going to enforce the law well, we need to make that very narrow distinction.
Before we let you go, Monica, you have written recently about the latest incident of a teacher being fired for, quote unquote, misgendering a student. Tell us about that.
Yes, so this is a really interesting story because the teacher actually did everything in his power to accommodate a student who had the year prior been a male, came back to school, they were identifying as female, and they wanted to use the corresponding pronouns. And this teacher immediately went to administration and said, I feel uncomfortable, I'm a Christian, I think that God created man male and female, you can't switch between the two, but I want the student to be comfortable. And so the solution that this teacher pursued was simply, I'm not going to use pronouns in the student's presence at all, so I don't have to speak against my conscience, and they also feel comfortable in the classroom. Unfortunately, that was not enough to satisfy the student's parents or the school board, and the school board voted unanimously last month to fire this teacher, who is the father of several children, was fired right before the Christmas season, and they were trying to pursue a solution where everyone could feel comfortable and embraced by the community. And the tragic thing is that we should expect to see more cases like Mr. Vlaming's in the future as these anti-discrimination policies become the norm. And fairness for all would not protect people like Peter Vlaming. We should not expect that to be the solution.
Monica Burke is research assistant in the DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society at the Heritage Foundation. You'll find a link to her work for the Daily Signal at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Monica, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Leading social conservatives like Anthony Esselin, Ryan Anderson, Scott Klusendorf, and others are featured on a recording of our 2018 Making the Case conferences. You can receive a thumb drive or an audio DVD recording of these conferences for a year-end tax-deductible donation of $300 or more to Issues, etc. Learn more and order at issuesetc.org or make your check payable to Issues, etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. It's almost 20 hours of teaching, preaching, and singing on a recording of our spring and fall Making the Case conferences. In Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., we conclude our series on the U.S. Constitution with Dr. Russell Dawn. We'll talk about the idea of a living Constitution, where it came from, and where it's taken us.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Rocking around the Christmas tree.
Have a holly jolly Christmas.
It's the most wonderful time.
Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell.
Tired of an endless loop of pop Christmas music? Coming December 24th, Sacred Music for the Christmas Season, LutheranPublicRadio.org. Serenity. Stability. Solemnity. Lutheran Public Radio, Sacred Music for the Christmas Season, coming Christmas Eve at LutheranPublicRadio.org.